Peter expressed in his first epistle, "In like manner let wives be subject to their husbands, so that even if any do not believe the word, they may without word be won through the behavior of their wives, observing reverently your chaste behavior." Sharing. To love is also to share. This sharing is difficult when one is confronted with someone who does not hunger. When I speak of sharing, I think especially of having spiritual goods in common. If you do not let him see your soul with its desires, its joys, its aspirations, its profound life, how do you expect him to love you? The discovery of your living soul will come one day after he has regained his sight and awakened his heart. But if you shut him off today, if you refuse him what is lovable in you, you will not help him to love. Why do so many couples forget that one of the great laws of love is to work each day for a new conquest of their partner? As in the first days, the way remains the same, to please. Women have a duty of elegance which consists especially in the cultivation of elegance of soul, as recommended by Saint Peter, but does not authorize them, for all that, to neglect the charm of their appearance. To men I would recall what they know well, that a woman needs to admire her husband and that they hold a woman's esteem by their manly virtues, strength of soul, spirit of decision, mastery of judgment, the social graces. I do not hesitate to add, know how to share your grievances. Be distrustful of this wall of silence which separates two beings more surely than the oceans. Allow communication, invite it, even provoke it. The hours in the calm of the evening are helpful when, all irritation having subsided, the couples confide in each other what weighs on their hearts. Not to assuage their egoism, but for love. A fault admitted is a fault half forgiven. The meaning of suffering. Discord only achieves tragic proportions and disturbs hearts when the couples omit to turn to God to see the providential meaning of their problems. For they have a meaning, these ordeals which seem absurd. Certainly God does not wish evil. He who repeated with insistence, "Be ye one," does not wish discord. But he wishes his children to triumph over evil and that suffering be for them the occasion to grow in natural and supernatural worth. When one understands his desire, it is possible still to know moments of defeat, but one has the strength to surmount these moments of confusion and temptation and to accept the ordeal. Acceptance is not, however, the resignation of which I spoke above, but a realistic vision of the situation, an indispensable condition for all work of reconstruction. A woman who has suffered much gives us a poignant example of this acceptance. Once you have accepted the state of trouble in your home, you may find it necessary to love it more than ever, the way a mother cherishes and cares for her abnormal and deficient child with ever more devotion. They love this home, though, with its faults, its gray and peevish atmosphere. They love it and they are more inclined to care for this delicate object, this pale lamp always ready to go out, these embers without heat which they sweep up, which they guard twice as much because they are fragile. And if the little ones around them suffer from these misunderstandings and coldness, they love them twice as much, trying to compensate a little. If one of the partners alone undertakes this task while the other is swallowed up in his villainy or his vices, alas! In that case he must love and watch twice as much. He is alone watching and loving, since the other is temporarily remiss. Where in a light and warm home a loving heart would have sufficed, here in this sick home a burning incandescent heart is needed. In those who accept, peace is established, the dialogue with God begins again. In him they discover an ally, an indefatigable devotion. Confidence returns. Thus aided, they can hope to remake the unity of their home. Perhaps this will be an arduous, exhausting work. One must pay the price. In fixing his eyes on Christ, who, to save men, prayed and gave his life, they will find the courage to pray and to do penance in their turn. They will figure that they have not done everything since they have not given everything. Much more than a model, Christ will be a companion to them, an everyday friend. Tearing the heart away from an obsession with suffering will not be the least of the benefits of this religious effort. Understand, I do not extol evasion, that frequent and subtle temptation that one must pitilessly ward off, but it is not an evasion to undertake the salvation of the home by being drawn closer to God through the ordeal. What revenge on evil that it serves to make love greater! Would an easy happiness have been as favorable to this spiritual ascension? In the heart racked by suffering, Christ can take that much greater a place. In conclusion, I would like to speak of the truest incentive you have for hope, your sacrament of marriage. It is to your home a source of strength, to make your union succeed, which uses the least of your efforts, even the blunders and the faults. Just as, in the order of nature, the energies that God has poured out only manifest themselves in their full vigor if men cooperate with them by their own work and industry. So the strength of grace, which by the sacrament lives up in the soul, must be brought to fruition by the goodwill and the work of men pious I. It is your confidence which permits this great sacrament to exercise its full efficacy. Therefore multiply your acts of faith in its power to obtain grace, healing, pacifying, comforting, unifying. The same pious I wrote, "You have the right to the help of actual grace." Do you understand what is extraordinary in these words, "You have the right"? The defeat of a home is often the fault of its faith. The true Christian knows that there are no hopeless situations. If he taps the rock, a spring may spout forth, the hardest heart may open itself, the desert may flower. And how beautiful is love after the ordeal! So much stronger, purer, and more transparent than the first day. I don't love him anymore. After 12.5 years of marriage, a woman without children perceived that her husband was unfaithful to her. At this crucial moment for her home and for herself, she met a priest about whom she knew very little and to whom for that very reason she unfolded her story. This priest, knowing almost nothing of her and of the home, rather than multiply counsels, suggested questions to her for self-examination. She saw him again, at regular intervals, during more than a year. Each time, on her return, she made notes on the salient points of the conferences, in a stenographic and almost impersonal style, for she had a horror of intimate diaries and of true confessions. The crisis at home evolved very slowly toward a favorable outcome. Some years later she found the notes which she had jotted down, and was going to bum them. But she thought, "They helped me, might they not help other women?" So she sent them to the priest who had counseled her, with these words, "Make whatever use of these seems best. They will not make a good article, but perhaps in their outline form they will be more useful than well-polished prose. A sentence is often enough to enlighten, and to save a life." July 10, 1950. Make an effort to understand him. Leap over the barrier. Pass into his camp. And for love of him, not yourself, help him to become faithful again. As long as you stay on your side, not seeing his point of view, you can be of no help to him. Why see in what has happened to Hymenley a deliberate betrayal? Perhaps his infidelity is only in the carnal order, and if this is so, he probably does not think less of you. Why deny that he is still able to love you? Therefore do not discard your love. If his infidelity is on the level of the heart, the occasion may not be as sordid as you imagine it. Perhaps it may have sprung from pity. Could he have wished perhaps to help a weak, abandoned person in distress? August 8, 1950. He is going through agonizing hours, hours of weakness of which he will be ashamed, but surely also hours of repossession of himself which will lead him to you. He must therefore find in you a welcome and receptivity which he will need to make amends. Has he perhaps already wanted to break with this woman and recoiled from it, frightened by the suffering it would provoke? I am tempted to believe that he is fearfully tempted to ways. "Didn't you say to me, he is no longer as happy as he was at the beginning of the affair, when he had that same kind of happiness which I had seen on his face 12 years ago, when I first met him. August 29, 1950. You speak of his contradictions. At certain times he seems to count on your love, at others, he seems intent on discouraging it. Not knowing him myself, I am reduced to guessing. One guess is suggested to me by the confidences of a man whose wife succeeded in saving him from the worst. In his case, hatred of self had engendered hatred of life, and he wavered on the brink of despair. He wanted to be able to deny all goodness, all love, then, having no more to hope from anyone else, he would be able to despair of himself. He would be able to hate himself, having become certain that nothing in him merited love anymore. It would be like an authorization to destroy himself, to let himself slip into hell. But no, each time that he tried to reason thus, to be sure, it was not reasoning, but that diabolical dialectic which led Judas to the tree of despair, the memory, the certitude, the undeniable fact of the love of his wife forced itself upon him. It was impossible to break this tie that held him, that kept him from making the final leap of despair. He tried to discourage the love of his wife, but in vain, she loved him. And so he did not succeed in hating himself, destroying himself, taking the final step. You, too, I beg of you, stay firm so that your love will not fail, whatever your husband says, whatever he does. Do not lose sight of the image of God in him, more or less buried, a live coal in the ashes. By the strength of love you will help him recover love of himself, love of you, and love of God. October 3, 1950. Do not listen to those who tell you that all means to recapture him are good. No. Use only the faithful weapons of love. Love has led you out of yourself, you must hold on to this gain. Be careful, self-pity risks closing you up in yourself again. You are profoundly humiliated by all these things. I understand that, but does the offense to God upset you as much as the offense to yourself? November 17, 1950. He sees you sad and nervous. At one time this made him tender, today it exasperates him. He reproaches you for your fatigue, your insomnia. Of course, that annoys him. It would be so much easier if you were radiant and he could tell himself that he was taking nothing from you by giving himself to another. What should you do? Cultivate sadness to move him? Or seem gay to avoid scenes? No, neither blackmail of the heart nor imitation of happiness will help. Careful, it is not blackmail, but love which succeeds. At the same time, do not be an accomplice. He will perhaps try to introduce you to the other, to make you admit her to receptions and gatherings in your home. It is not necessary, under the guise of charity, to abandon your dignity. You refuse yourself to him? Ethically you may. But ethics has never taught that the highest love lies in refusal. It is not a question of being justified before him, it is a question of assenting to this higher law of love, and of finding in it the light to guide your actions. I agree that cowardice and weakness are not Christian, but pardon is not cowardice or weakness. The disciple of Christ must learn to pardon not 7 times but 70 times 7. Do not listen to those who counsel separation. Do not transform a crisis into a state. To ask for separation would be to deny your promises, it would be to abandon him. Do not answer infidelity by infidelity. December 10, 1950. While this drama in your life may seem absurd, it nevertheless has a meaning. Everything has a meaning in a world where nothing escapes the providence of God. It is putting your fidelity to the test, and it is also the purification of your love. You must eliminate all the germs of idolatry and egoism which persist tenaciously in all love. Do not refuse purification. Forbid yourself to take his sin as an excuse to harbor within you the pernicious fruits of jealousy, rancor and hate, and to regret the gifts which you have bestowed on him. You ask me, can sin have something good in it? Can it produce good fruits?